And the government got behind the IFFT. We synchronized the message and efforts, brought all the stakeholders to the table. It was all about changing lifestyle. It was our only weapon in the fight. And it worked. The U.S. Census Bureau and UN AIDS program estimated that there was a 67% drop in HIV/AIDS infections in Uganda between 1991 and 2001. Millions of lives were saved. Children who would have been born with HIV, a death sentence then, were spared. They grew up healthy, with a shot at a normal life. I think Andrew would have said that was a cause worth fighting for and dying for. Charlotte grew quiet. We had talked about getting married after our tours were up in Uganda. I've often wondered what my life would have been like if we had. She glanced at the old tape. Seeing this again, it's tough. It brings back so many memories. Peyton couldn't help wondering what could have been. Charlotte, this woman who seemed good-hearted and dedicated, could have been her sister-in-law. The thought made her miss her brother even more. Yes, William said. It was indeed bittersweet to watch. I think for all of us. Thank you for showing us the video, Charlotte. It means a great deal.
Of course.
They walked back to Charlotte's office in silence. Ahead, Peyton heard papers rustling. Someone was waiting for them. Charlotte pushed the door open. Standing inside her office were three men in woodland camo. Two pointed rifles at Charlotte and the others. Another was looking through the folder from our ASK-7. Peyton turned and saw two more soldiers blocking the end of the hall. "Don't do anything stupid," said the soldier, looking through the file. "No one needs to die here." Chapter 101 Elliot hadn't seen or heard anything from the authorities all day. The BioShield convoys that distributed food hadn't come. And just like yesterday, the Rook Quantum Sciences app hadn't prompted him to take the daily survey. Rumors were going around. The most pervasive was that the government had developed a cure but was hoarding it. Another theory went that the government was preparing for a world war, conscripting survivors and leaving the sick to die. With each passing hour, the absence of food and medicine made the rumors more believable. Elliot sat in his study, thinking about what was happening. In his mind's eye, he saw Rose, sick and alone, lying on a blanket in the Georgia Dome, coughing, burning up with fever. The people who had cared for her were now gone. They were preparing to protect the downtown cordon headquarters from the mobs descending upon it. The city was tearing itself apart. He imagined Ryan, a physician, charged with caring for the wounded in the battle, trapped, his own life in danger. He thought about his grandson, Adam, whose cough was getting worse each day. Ibuprofen no longer controlled the fever. Sam was dedicating herself completely to caring for the boy now. She had given up on trying not to get infected. From his window, Elliot could see a convoy of trucks moving slowly down his street. Men and a few women sat on the backs of the trucks, rifles in their hands. They hopped out and walked to each door, talking with the neighbors. When the knock at his door came, Elliot answered it, careful not to swing the door too wide. A man in his 30s with a weather-beaten face, long brown hair, and a beard stood on his doorstep. He had left the rifle on the truck. His hands were held in front of him, slightly raised, showing that he meant no harm. He said his name was Shane, and that he and his wife had a daughter being held downtown. "We're going after her. A lot of other folks are heading that way, too. We ain't looking for a fight. Just want to get our people and leave in peace. We're going out to the country to try to make it. Just letting you know, if you want to come along." Shane glanced at the RV. "Maybe take some people with you. More numbers we got, more chance they'll just stand down." Elliot considered this. "I've heard the roads are blocked. Military checkpoints." Shane glanced back at the truck. "Yeah, we got a plan for that." He stepped away from the door. "Hope you join us. Either way, good luck." Back in his study, Elliot watched several neighbors raise their garage doors, get in their cars and trucks, and join the growing convoy. When the procession had departed, the neighbors Elliot had convened at his home days earlier once again descended on his house. He gathered them in his study, where they sat and argued. Finally, Elliot said, "Okay, stop. Raise your hand if someone in your family is being held in the downtown quarantine zone." 4 hands went up. "Raise a hand if you've got someone sick at home." 3 more hands went up. He leaned back in his chair. Here's what we're going to do. At the CDC headquarters, Millen stood at a seventh-floor window. Below, his colleagues and other BioShield staff were filing out, loading onto the city buses and school buses. Phil walked up and stood beside him, but said nothing.
Where would they take them? Millen asked.
Outside the cordon. Hopefully outside the battle lines. Millen watched figures in FEMA jackets loading food into a box van. 10 minutes ago, Millen had heard a rumor that the president had died from X-1 Mandera, or had been assassinated.
Is it true? The president's dead?
Yeah.
Who's in charge?
One way or another, I'd say the Sishim is in charge now. 30 minutes later, Millen was wearing a positive pressure suit. The door to the BSL-4 lab hissed open, and he walked in to find Halima lying on the bed, watching the portable DVD player. Tian was playing with a handheld game console. Halima smiled at Millen and put the DVD player aside.
I was worried. Everyone left.
Millen set some food on the steel-top table.
Are you hungry? Starving. No one came this afternoon. All the researchers stormed out. We couldn't hear what they were saying.
Millen forced his voice to remain calm.
It's nothing. Just urgent meetings. I'll bring the food from now on. Would you like that?
She nodded as she took a bite of the sandwich.
Good. I'll come back in a few hours.
And he would. He had made a promise to take care of the two Kenyans, and it was a promise he intended to keep. His parents had taught him to take his commitments very seriously. He wondered where his parents were now, if they were safe. There wasn't much he could do for them, but he would do everything he could for the people of Atlanta and the two Kenyan villagers in his care. Upstairs, he walked to the EOC, sat at his desk, and studied the satellite images. He pulled on his headset and typed, Med Supply Unit 227, be advised, combat units are assembling at Mitchell and Central Ave to meet hostiles inbound. Estimate 200, heavily armed en route with others arriving. Recommend you fall back to Rally Point Gamma Bravo. Alim Kibit rode in the passenger seat of the box truck that rolled through the littered streets of Nairobi. Buildings were burned. Cars lay in charred ruins. Children with blood on their faces watched the truck go by, the flames and smoke behind them a heartbreaking backdrop. Alim could hardly look. His country's capital city had fallen. He hoped that somewhere in the wreckage he'd find survivors he could save, and IV antibiotics. Hannah was in the truck behind him. She would die soon without them. The stoplights were dark and lifeless. At an intersection, the lead truck in the convoy paused as the driver checked the cross street. It was blocked off with two burned cars. Roadblocks. Alim felt a tinge of nervousness. Someone raised their head above one of the burned cars, peered at the truck, then ducked back down.
Go,
Alim said. The driver of the truck floored it, but it was too late. Ahead, two armored troop carriers pulled into the street, blocking it. Armed men poured out, guns held at the ready. In the side mirror, Alim saw a similar force pull up behind the convoy. They were trapped. Chapter 102. Desmond lay on the metal floor of the cargo container in almost complete darkness. At the burned ruins of his childhood home, the soldiers had zip-tied his hands and placed a black bag over his head. They hadn't pulled it off until they'd shoved him in the container. His cell, such as it was, had 6 round holes about a foot off the floor, each about an inch in diameter. Desmond figured they were there to let air in, or perhaps for warehouse employees to verify the container's contents without opening it. He pressed an eye to one of them. Rows and stacks of cargo containers sat on a concrete floor. After a few minutes of searching, he found a twisted edge on the corrugated metal wall. In the dim light, he carefully placed the zip tie against the sharp metal and sawed back and forth until his hands came free. He heard tapping against the wall of another container. A pattern. Morse code, he thought. Someone in another container? Desmond didn't know Morse code. He tapped 3 times to acknowledge that he had heard the signal. 3 taps responded from the original location. Then 3 more. And 3 more, both from different locations. So including himself, there were 4 of them. He was sure Avery would have captured William and Peyton. William was probably the one who'd started the Morse code tapping.
Who was the fourth captive?
Charlotte? Because they'd told her too much? Someone tapped a new pattern. This one wasn't Morse code, and it was familiar to Desmond. He squinted, listened, then grinned. The taps mimicked the theme song to the X-Files. It ended with a large single tap. He rolled to the metal wall, began tapping the same refrain back. 20 years ago, he had sat on a cloth couch in a living room in a small home in Palo Alto and watched the show every Friday night, Peyton beside him, a cup of tea in her hands, occasionally a glass of wine if she'd had a tough week at med school. Desmond would have given anything to go back there and start over. He wondered if it was too late for the two of them. He knew Peyton had been hiding how sick she was. How much time did she have? The thought filled Desmond with energy. He had to find a way out of the box. Connor McLean sat at the head of the conference table, waiting for the call to connect. He was nervous. The Sishium were on the cusp of completing their great experiment. In the following days, 2,000 years of work would come to fruition, or fail. And now he had the last piece they needed, Desmond Hughes. If Avery had completed her mission, the man had recovered his memories, and the details of how to retrieve rendition. Letting him go had been a risk, but one he'd felt he had to take. The call connected, and the screen showed a view of an industrial office with cheap furniture. Plate glass windows looked down on a warehouse full of metal shipping containers. A man in woodland camo stood next to a solid wood desk covered in nicks and scratches, papers strewn across its surface. Avery stood beside the man, her arms crossed just below her breasts, her blonde hair hanging down, her gray-blue eyes cold. Connor found her incredibly attractive.
He wondered what might develop between them when this was over.
She'd had no interest before, but soon, he would be the second most powerful person in the world. That might change things. The man spoke first.
We've got them. Why were they in Australia?
A woman, Avery said. Charlotte Christensen.
Connor had never heard the name.
Who is she?
A relief worker who took care of Desmond after the Ash Wednesday fires.
Interesting.
We captured her as well, just in case she's connected somehow.
Avery leaned off the desk.
We'll bring them to you.
Now, we need... I'll come there when this is finished.
Avery's eyes flashed. Connor couldn't read the expression, but he thought it was anger.
We had a deal, she said, her voice hard.
We still have a deal.
I want in.
You'll get in. When I say so.
Connor paused, letting his words hang in the air. Avery exhaled, broke eye contact with him, and slouched back against the desk.
I want him well guarded, Connor said. As you know, he's a very resourceful man.
Chapter 103 Alim opened the truck door. The driver yelled at him to stay inside, but Alim knew that what he was about to do was his only choice, perhaps his convoy's only hope of surviving the ambush. Into his radio, he called for everyone to stay inside their vehicles. His white coat made him less likely to be gunned down than the rifle-carrying men in the canvas-backed trucks behind him. He stepped down from the box truck's cab, held his hands up, and marched forward. The troops exiting the armored personnel carriers came into focus. Alim exhaled when he saw their uniforms. Kenyan Army. When he had seen the ambush, he had assumed the worst, that it was gang-related. An officer strode forward. He was coughing. The lapels of his uniform were stained red, and his eyes were yellow and bloodshot. His voice was much stronger than his appearance.
Who are you? Dr. Alim Kibit. We're survivors, and we're here to help.
Alim found the Kenyan Ministry of Health in shambles. The emergency operations center wasn't staffed, and the phones were ringing constantly. To Demiria, he said,
Get people in here. Have them start answering these phones. Tell callers that we will send help when we can and to do their best until we get there. They need to hear that.
Kenyatta National Hospital was in even worse shape. Dead bodies lay on gurneys. People filled the waiting room. Blood covered the floor and walls. The staff had bags under their jaundiced eyes. Most were like walking zombies. They had been working so long they could hardly think. Alim insisted they take a break. He sent every one of the doctors and most of the nurses to the on-call rooms in a hotel nearby. They were too tired to argue with the newcomer. Then he had his people set about cleaning up the hospital. Over the next 4 hours, Kenya's oldest and largest hospital went from a bloody, disheveled mess to at least some semblance of a functioning trauma and referral hospital. He stood in Hannah's room now, gazing down at her. Even before the first mop had gone across the floors, before disinfectant was sprayed on the walls, Alim had made sure she was brought in, placed in a patient room, and hooked to IV antibiotics. She would survive the infection, but the virus was overtaking her body. Organ failure was beginning. She hadn't even woken up when they'd brought her in. She would die within hours. The thought saddened him. It also reminded him of Lucas Turner, the other young American he had tried to save. He stood for a long moment, then pulled the thin white blanket up to her chin and walked to the window. A line had formed outside the hospital. That was good. There were still people healthy enough to get here. He had work to do. The CDC was in chaos. In EOC, operators were ending their calls, getting up and rushing out of the room. Millen stood at his desk. On the wall screen, scenes of the fall of Atlanta played without sound. The mobs were massing on the combined BioShield troops, which included Army, Navy, Marine, Air Force, and National Guard units. Many of those in uniform had lain down their arms and walked across the line to join the gathering crowd. They had taken an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And for many of them, that didn't extend to shooting their own mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, and neighbors when they were simply sick and seeking help. Millen couldn't blame them. He wondered what he would do if he were on the line in riot gear. Phil walked up behind him. Millen thought his supervisor was going to reprimand him for not answering the call beeping on his headset, but instead he told Millen to follow him. At a floor-to-ceiling glass window on the 7th floor, they looked down Clifton Road. A crowd of people filled all 5 lanes, but a procession of 3 pickup trucks, each with men on the back holding semi-automatic rifles, weaved through the mob toward the line of BioShield troops who formed a perimeter around the CDC complex. The trucks were like a fuse on a bomb. Would the scene erupt when they reached the troops? Would the shooting start? "This could get ugly," Millen said. Stevens nodded. "Isn't there something you should be doing?" Comprehension dawned on Millen. He turned on his heel and ran. At the kitchen off the cafeteria, he stuffed food into garbage bags. He needed non-perishable items, enough for at least 4 days. The halls were filled with people, everyone arguing about what to do. They were scared. So was Millen. He found the BSL-4 lab empty once again. He donned the suit, entered, and placed the food on one of the tables inside. Halima was asleep. He hated to wake her, but he had to. After the 3rd gentle nudge, she opened her eyes, rubbed them, and smiled. She saw the fear on his face instantly. "What's wrong? I might be going away for a while. I need you to stay here. It's important, you understand?" She nodded. "If you run out of food before I'm back, you can leave. But be careful. Don't tell anyone you're from Kenya. Tell them you've lost your parents and they didn't want you to talk to strangers." She looked confused, but agreed. Outside the BSL-4, he doffed the suit and changed quickly. When he reached the ground floor, he heard gunshots. Chapter 104. Auditorium A at CDC headquarters was again packed to capacity. Millen stood with the other staff, listening to Phil outline the evacuation plan. It was ingenious. The train tracks that ran behind the CDC were free of the mobs that had massed outside demanding the cure. And within 10 minutes, train cars would be whisking the staff to safety. "The people at the back of the room will guide you to the exit," Phil said. Millen fell in line, flowing with the crowd that rushed out of the room. In the distance, past the lobby, he heard more gunshots. Instead of going outside, he broke from the crowd, made his way to the stairs, and descended to the lab level. He didn't don a protective suit this time. Pretty soon, he wouldn't need it, one way or another. Inside the lab, he found Halima watching a DVD. She pulled one of the headphones out of her ear. "No suit?" He shook his head. "Mind if I join you?" He had made his decision. He would stay in the lab and try to protect the 2 children until the end. Leaving would mean saving only himself, and that wasn't good enough. The Atlanta streets were clogged with cars, some leaving the city, just as many going downtown to search for their loved ones in BioShield confinement. That's exactly what Elliot and his neighbors had done. Split up. One group had taken an RV and left the city, just in case it became a war zone between BioShield troops and citizens. Elliot sat behind the wheel of the other RV, driving toward downtown Atlanta. The massive vehicle was over 30 feet long. He had driven buses during deployments, some on muddy dirt roads in the Third World, and none of them compared to this. He weaved the RV in and out of traffic, dodging stopped cars on I-75. Up ahead, the freeway was completely blocked with abandoned vehicles. He veered to the side, taking the exit for Howell Mill Road. He wasn't sure if he was driving the massive RV or if it was driving him. It rocked like a fish being pulled from the water. His 12 passengers gripped the kitchenette table, the walls, and anything they could get their hands on.
"Sorry!"
Elliot yelled back as the RV coasted to a stop at the top of the ramp. He got as far as Marietta Street before the roads were completely blocked. He pulled the RV into an alley. About half the people on board rose and moved to the door. Sam and Adam were among those who were going to stay. If things went as planned, Elliot would be back soon, and they'd all be leaving together. He looked at his neighbors and their teenage children, wondering what they were about to confront. Were they ready? He had no idea, but he knew they had no choice.
"You have your sticks?"
The question was met with yeses and nods.
"Good. Let's try to stay together."
He held up a can of orange spray paint.
"Remember the breadcrumbs if we get separated."
After the others exited, he walked back to Sam and Adam. The boy was lying on the RV's bed with several other younger kids who were sick, all playing portable video games. To Sam, Elliot said,
"I'll be back soon. Don't worry."
Tears welled in her eyes. He pulled her into a tight hug, reached over and tousled Adam's hair, then made his way outside. He and his neighbor Bill covered the monstrous vehicle with several tarps. Elliot's fever had been low-grade this morning, and to his relief, he was feeling pretty good at the moment. The adrenaline was likely helping. Elliot gathered everyone around him. It was cold in the alley, and his breath came out in a puff of white steam.
"Remember, the knock is 3 raps, pause, then 2, then 1. 3, 2, 1. We're going to wait here until all of us report back. There's food in the RV, blankets too. Use the portable batteries and electric heater if you need them. Try not to crank it unless you have to."
Elliot looked each one of them in the eye.
"Okay. Good luck."
On the buildings flanking the alley, he spray-painted a large E. As they walked, he put the same mark on every building they passed. It felt strange, painting graffiti all over downtown Atlanta, but he hoped it might get one or more of his people back. He expected some or all of them would be in a very bad mental state when they returned. The streets were packed with people on foot, just like them, hiking toward downtown and the Georgia Dome, looking for their loved ones, or the cure, or both. Many carried guns and knives, while others simply jammed their hands in their coat pockets trying to stay warm. When Marietta Street met Northside Drive, Elliot heard the roar of heavy machinery. To his right, two bulldozers were pushing cars to the side, clearing a path. A front-end loader bounced along behind them. Two pickup trucks brought up the rear. Men in the beds held rifles. One of the men called to the crowd,
"They surrendered! Come on, follow us!"
People broke from the crowd, began falling in line. Elliot quickened his pace, jogging down Northside Drive. The heavy bulldozers had left track marks in the pavement, their own version of breadcrumbs leading to the Georgia Dome. People in orange vests were scattered along the road, making sure no cars blocked the cleared thoroughfare. Elliot and his neighbors were forced back onto the sidewalk along with everyone else when two tractor trailers powered down the road. The back doors to their empty trailers hung open, and men looked out, several of them smoking. It took Elliot a minute to realize why they needed the giant trucks, to hold all the guns they were rounding up. They were disarming the government troops. A few minutes later, school buses emerged from downtown, heading away from the Georgia Dome. They were the same buses that had taken him and Rose downtown, but now they were filled with uniformed people, National Guard, Army, and FEMA. the very people who had crowded Elliot and the rest of the population onto the buses days earlier. Along the street, some people clapped and cheered. Others, like Elliot, simply stared at the surreal scene. A few yelled out names and rushed toward the buses, but the orange-vested individuals held them back. That was something Elliot hadn't considered before, that some of the people making their way downtown were coming to help their friends and family in uniform. When the buses passed, he waded back into the street and ran even faster. The cold early December air burned in his lungs. He was very out of shape, even for his age. His younger neighbors were pulling ahead. He was slowing them down. "Go on," he said between breaths. Bill smiled. "A wise man told me we should stay together." Elliot just shook his head, but he was glad for the company. 3 blocks from the Georgia Dome, the crowd became too thick to run. Their group slowed to a walk, and Elliot caught his breath. He drew out his long stick, which he'd held to his body with his belt. Carefully, he unfolded the poster board sign and taped it to the stick. Then he passed around the tape, and one by one, they all raised their signs. Elliot's read, "Rose Shapiro." It was one of thousands of posters waving in the air as the crowd pressed toward the Georgia Dome. Chapter 105. Desmond was contemplating his escape from the cargo container when he heard a group of people marching across the concrete. The boots pounded in the vast space, drawing closer. It sounded like a stampede at first. Then there was a screeching sound and muffled voices. He recognized only one of them. A single set of footsteps resumed. The door to Desmond's container opened with another screech of metal on metal. The dark space flooded with light. He squinted, held an arm up to shade his eyes. Avery. The blonde was shrouded in shadow, but Desmond could see that she was still clad in tight-fitting body armor. She looked like a superhero. She held a handgun at her side, ready but not pointed at him. Her expression was remorseful, apologetic even. "I had to," she said. Desmond was stone-faced. "We were getting nowhere at Sarah. It was a dead end, Des." She waited, but he still said nothing, only stared at her. "This was my backup plan. We needed to get back inside the Sitium. I knew the tactical team was at the house waiting."
"You could have told me."
"I needed them to believe it."
"Like you needed us to believe the rescue was real."
Avery's silence confirmed his theory. He had suspected that the escape from the Kentaro Maru was staged. Now he knew for sure. He wanted to know why.
"They let me go because they wanted me to lead them, to lead you, to rendition."
"Yes. It's the only thing they need for the looking glass." She stepped away from the container. "Look, I took a risk. I didn't want the group to debate it because I knew it was the only option we had. And we didn't have time for our little committee to vote. It worked out better than I thought it would." She motioned away from Desmond's container. "Come on, I'll show you." Across the aisle, another cargo container lay open, its heavy metal doors revealing cardboard boxes stacked on pallets. The closest box had been torn open. It held hundreds of oblong handheld devices roughly half the size of a cell phone and a bit thicker. Avery handed him one. "It's a jet injector." She pointed to another box, which held CO2 cartridges. They were small and round, similar to the ones Desmond had used in his pellet gun as a child. "They're CO2 powered. She pulled another open box closer. It was full of vials. She took a vial and a CO2 cartridge and inserted both into the jet injector. "This is the cure. I thought if they captured us here in Australia that they might take us to a warehouse like this one." She waited for him to respond, but Desmond said nothing. "It was the only way, Des. Our only option." He took the device from her and stared at it. "We've done it." He held in his hand the key to saving Peyton and billions more. But it was her he thought of first. He realized then how worried he'd been about her. He didn't want to lose her, or the second chance he wanted so badly. Everything had happened so quickly in the last 2 weeks. He hadn't had time to process it. It all hit him now. They had found the cure, and they had a fighting chance of stopping the Sitium. Erasing his memories had been a big risk, but the clues he'd left himself had worked. In a roundabout way, they had led him here, to this moment, to what he thought was a turning point. Now it was time to finish it. Avery stepped closer. I mean it, Des. This was the only way. Do you believe me? She needs me to forgive her. There was a deeper relationship between them, and he couldn't remember it. That was an unsettling feeling. He looked at her, but he still didn't speak. It was the only way to get you off the ship, she said. It was the only way to get us here, to the cure. I gambled. I did what I had to. I did it for you and for the mission. Please tell me you understand. A cough rang out in the silence, a congested sick sound. Not a nagging nuisance cough, but a deadly one, like a bell tolling, reminding him that time was running out. Yeah, I understand, Avery. She didn't smile. She only glanced away, as if his words of absolution had come up short. He wasn't ready to forgive her. Not until he trusted her completely. And right now his only thoughts were for Peyton. He didn't want to wait another second to give her the cure. We've got some people who need this, he said. He followed the cough to another metal shipping container, unlocked it, and pulled the screeching metal door open. Peyton was lying on the floor, squinting at the bright light. She barely sat up. He handed Avery the jet injector, walked inside, and gathered Peyton in his arms. She felt like a rag doll as he lifted her and carried her into the light. She was no doubt worn out from the fitful sleep in the back of the plane on the way to Australia. Hungry, and exhausted from the sickness that had been slowly overtaking her. In the glow of sunlight through the skylights, he sat her on the concrete floor of the warehouse and held her head in his hands. Her eyelids were droopy, and her hair soaked with sweat, either from the fever or the hot southern Australian summer that was just beginning. Avery pulled Peyton's sleeve up and began to press the jet injector to her arm, but Desmond stopped her and took the device. He wanted to administer the cure to Peyton himself. He realized then how much it meant to him, and why. 20 years ago, they had spent the most important years of his life together. Perhaps of hers, too. He had discovered who he was. Before he met her, he had never known the true extent of the wounds from his childhood. He was broken. He had given up on waiting for his wounds to heal. He had left her, because he thought that by leaving, he was saving her. He thought he was giving her the life she deserved. He knew now that he had been wrong. He held the injector at her shoulder and pressed the button. The pop of air and the pinch snapped Peyton to attention. She looked from Avery to Desmond, then at the jet injector in his hand. Hi, he said. She smiled.
Hi.
Chapter 106. Everywhere Elliot looked, he saw death. The dead and dying lay on cots and blankets in rows on the infield of the Georgia Dome. The stench was overpowering. He gagged twice before he got used to it. He marched, his sign held high, searching for his wife's face or voice. His fear grew with each step. He tried in vain not to think about what he would do if he found her dead. Elliot had spent decades of his career working in field hospitals. He had treated the victims of outbreaks, just like the living and dead lying all around him. But none of it had prepared him for being on the other side, being a family member of someone infected, whose life would be claimed by the pathogen. It was a feeling of complete helplessness. Tears ran down his face. Very soon he would know whether X-1 Mandera had claimed the love of his life. He dreaded that knowledge, and at the same time he desperately wanted to know. Not knowing if she was alive and suffering, or gone and at peace, was tearing him apart. A voice he knew well called out, Dad! Elliot turned to see his son weaving through the crowd. When the 30-year-old physician reached Elliot, the older man pulled him in, hugging him hard. Your mom? Ryan nodded. She's alive. Elliot saw in his son's face the words he didn't say, but just barely. Are Sam and Adam with you? They're back at the RV. They're safe. Thank God. Are they? Sam's asymptomatic. Adam's infected, but it's still early stage. I'm so sorry, son. Ryan squeezed his dad's shoulders. It's not your fault. We'll deal with it. Come on, let's get Mom and get out of here. Elliot swallowed and steeled himself as Ryan led him into the Georgia Dome's offices. He was anxious and afraid and so eager to see her again. Rose lay on a cot in a small office, her eyes closed, pulse weak. Elliot did a quick examination. The rash on her abdomen was dark red and had spread up to her neck. Her face was ashen. Dark bags hung below her eyes. But she's alive. He was thankful to see her again, to hold her hand, still warm, pulse beating, if only to say goodbye. He turned to his son and told him what they had to do. Nearly an hour later, they reached the RV Elliot had parked off Marietta Street. He knocked three times, then two, then once, and waited. 3 seconds, then four. The door cracked, and he saw his neighbor's face. Ryan took off the blankets piled upon Rose. He hoisted her out of the wheelchair and carried her into the massive motorhome. The kids lounging on the bed sprang up at the sight, allowing Ryan to gently set his mother down on the bed. The instant he released her, Sam ran into his arms, and they were both crying and shaking as they hugged each other. Adam joined them, clinging to his parents, them embracing him, and Elliot was there too, wrapping his arms around the three of them for a few long seconds before crawling into the bed to lie beside Rose. They had brought medicine and oral rehydration salts, but for the most part, all they could do now was wait. Elliot pulled her freezing body close to his. The tears flowed fast now. "It's going to be okay, Rose. I'm here. We're going to fix this. Everything is going to be all right. You hear me?" She said nothing, but he felt one of her tears touch his cheek. He held her tighter. "Don't give up. Please." Chapter 107. After Desmond administered the cure to Peyton, he and Avery found William in another container and injected him with the cure. As Desmond had suspected, Charlotte was confined to a shipping container as well. Avery read his question before he asked. "I ordered the team at Sarah to capture her. It seems she's connected somehow." "That was good thinking." They freed Charlotte, and she thanked Desmond as he administered the cure. The warehouse was huge, the size of a football field, stacked three tall with sea freight containers in rows. According to Avery, the building was in Port Adelaide, a suburb northwest of Adelaide, Australia. She led them to an office above the warehouse floor, where two camo-clad soldiers were laid out, glassy eyes staring at the ceiling, both shot in the chest, center mass. "Where are the rest of the soldiers?" Desmond asked. "In a cargo container," Avery said. "They were more compliant." Desmond still didn't know what to make of the woman, but he knew she was deadly efficient. The five of them gathered around a large table the shipping company had likely used to plan routes and review manifests. Plate glass windows looked down on the warehouse floor and the rows of cargo containers below. A window on an adjacent wall revealed a harbor where cargo ships were docked. William focused on Desmond.
"Did you reach the labyrinth location before they captured you?"
In his peripheral vision, Desmond saw Avery cut her eyes to him.
"Yes."
He paused, considering what to say.
"Well?"
William said, eager.
"What did you find?"
"A memory." Peyton bunched up her eyebrows, studying him. "It wasn't..." Desmond searched for the words. If he told them the truth, there would be an argument for sidelining him going forward. He couldn't let that happen. Stopping the Sishim was more important to him than ever. The memory was from the day of the fire. It was personal, not related to the Sishim or the pandemic. William eyed him.
"Are you certain?"
"Yeah."
"In that case," said Avery, opening a laptop, "I've got something you all need to see."
Desmond couldn't read the expression on her face, but he was thankful for the change in subject. She told them that the computer had belonged to one of the Sishim soldiers, whom she had persuaded to provide the password. She played the two messages the Sishim had sent to the U.S. and other governments. Charlotte and Peyton stood aghast. Desmond was deep in thought. William turned and stared at the rows of shipping containers, then spoke slowly, in a reflective tone.
"That confirms it. They mass-produced the cure and shipped it to sites like this around the world, so they'd be ready to release it quickly."
He turned to the group.
"Governments need to begin searching ports and shipping terminals for the warehouses like this one."
Avery typed on the laptop.
"That's going to be a problem."
Video feeds showed drone footage above the streets of major cities. Desmond recognized the Golden Gate Bridge in one feed. People were rioting, marching upon AT&T Park. Similar scenes played out in Chicago, New York, London, Moscow, and Shanghai. Peyton crossed her arms. It's a global civil war. And the Sishyam's winning, Desmond thought. If the people who had started the pandemic got control of world governments, what would they do next? They were capable of anything. But what was their endgame? To William, Desmond asked, why are they trying to take over world governments? I'm not sure. Well, I have a theories. If they're still pursuing the looking glass device proposed in 1983, they need a massive amount of power and a large data communication network. The internet, for example. Controlling world governments would provide them with both. The chaos serves another purpose. It keeps governments from conducting a search effective enough to find the cure distribution sites. They might find a few, but not all of them, not quickly enough. We need to help them. There has to be a list of the sites, Desmond said. He turned to Avery. Can you do a search? Avery was already typing furiously. No, this laptop only has information on what's happening at this facility. It's standard Sishyam policy, compartmentalization. William walked across the room to a window that looked out onto the pier in the harbor beyond. They wouldn't be that sloppy. These people are very, very smart and efficient. He pointed out the window to the harbor and a docked container ship. But if we can find the ship that delivered the cure here and see where it's been, we might be able to figure out where they manufactured it. And that location will likely have a list of all the destinations the cure was shipped to. He turned to Avery. Is there any navigational data from ships that docked? She worked the laptop. It looks like the nav data downloads automatically when the ships make contact, but warehouse staff delete the records after review. She raised her eyebrows. Hold on. They haven't deleted the records for the most recent ship. The MV Ascension. Her eyes scanned the screen. It's still docked here. Desmond felt a rush of hope. Read the ports of call. Hong Kong, Singapore, Port Klang, Shenzhen, Ho Chi Minh City, Kaohsiung. Avery looked up. This doesn't make sense. The ship's always full when it makes port, but it never takes on containers. William stepped closer. We're looking for a recurring location. It will occur after every port. Avery worked the laptop. There's nothing, just an entry for speculum. That's it. I've never heard of it, Desmond said. It's a Latin word. It translates to looking glass. On the Beagle, it was our code word for the isle. William paused. Yes, it makes sense.
What makes sense? Peyton asked.
I think they created the virus at Arask 7, William said. He turned to Desmond. You saw the subjects in the testing wing, but I don't think they manufactured the cure there. Why? Simple logistics. Think about it. The virus is highly contagious. They wouldn't need a large amount to spread it. Maybe a few hundred or thousand doses strategically placed around the world. Arask 7 could easily manufacture and transport enough viral material to seed the outbreak. But manufacturing the cure and shipping it around the world, that's a task on a completely different scale. We're talking about billions of doses. Sea freight is the only thing that makes sense. It's the cheapest way to transport bulk goods, and it allows them to reach any port in the world within a short amount of time. He nodded. It's the Isle. This is their manufacturing center, I'm sure of it. It might even be their HQ.
Wait. Charlotte said. Why did they make all the shipments over the years to Sarah? No one is sick there.
William shook his head. I don't know. I still don't understand how you and Sarah fit in. It's almost like the shipments were unrelated to the pandemic. Maybe we obtained the wrong file at Arask 7. I'm sorry we involved you in this, Charlotte.
I'm not. If Sarah is somehow connected to the Sishyam, if they used us somehow, I want to know why, and what they did to my people.
I don't blame you. William turned to the group. Look, we need to move quickly. I believe we should assume that somewhere on the aisle is a list of the warehouse locations.
Okay, Desmond said.
But you said this place would be very well guarded. So what are you thinking? Can we contact the U.S. military somehow and get them to send in special forces to raid the island?
We'll need to go with them.
William motioned to Avery.
At least, Avery and I will need to. I know the island layout, and she has familiarity with the computer systems. We'll go in covertly. A head-on assault would be doomed.
Desmond spoke quickly. No way I'm sitting this one out.
That goes for me too, Peyton said.
No, Peyton, you're too sick. I know you've been trying to hide it.
She stared into his eyes. I'm not 100%, but I'm close enough. They killed a lot of my people, and they're killing a lot more people I've dedicated my life to protecting.
William focused on Peyton.
It's simply too dangerous.
Dad, going into dangerous situations is part of my job. I'm all grown up now, and I make my own decisions.
She glanced back and forth between Desmond and her father.
I'm going. And I'm going as well,
Charlotte said. Desmond shook his head. Charlotte.
These terrorists funded my work for some reason. Sent potentially dangerous material to my camp for years. I have to know why. And I might know something that we don't even realize. Something that could help when we get there. If there's even a remote chance that I could help, I have to try. Billions of lives are at stake. I'm going. I know the risks. I accept them.
Desmond looked to William for help, but the older man just shrugged. Apparently he too sensed that they were fighting a losing battle. They weren't going to keep Peyton and Charlotte off the team, no matter how much they wanted to.
Fine, Desmond said. Let's assume that this island is our best shot at finding where the shipments of cure have been sent.
He looked around, watching the silent nods from the group.
So how do we even get there?
We can't exactly fly there. Landing on the island would end our little adventure pretty quickly. And by the time we get there by sea, the world as we know it will be over.
I think I can help with that,
Avery said. She drew a cell phone from her pocket and affixed a satellite sleeve. Desmond watched her activate an app called North Star. She shot him a sly smile.
It turns out I didn't trust you either.
The app beeped once, a long drone. Then a man's voice came over the speaker.
Ops.
Avery smiled.
We found it.
Chapter 108. Desmond was pushing the 20-foot box truck's engine to its limits, trying to keep up with Avery's truck ahead. She was barreling down the deserted streets of Port Adelaide with reckless abandon. They hadn't seen a soul, but Desmond was still concerned that they might hit a pedestrian. Peyton sat in the passenger seat, gripping the handle on the ceiling. She apparently was concerned, too.
I wish she'd slowed down,
Peyton yelled over the roaring engine. Desmond nodded, but he had to admit, time was not on their side. Every minute that passed, people lost their lives. William sat behind the wheel of the truck behind them, keeping up as best he could. In the rear view, Desmond saw Charlotte in the passenger seat with an expression of terror similar to Peyton's. At the Sitium warehouse, Avery's North Star app had connected her to the Rubicon Command Center, but quickly gotten in touch with the U.S. and Australian militaries to coordinate the plan. They had directed Avery and the team to take as many doses of the cure as possible to the Royal Australian Air Force Base at Edinburgh, South Australia, and to expect details of additional arrangements by the time they got there. At the base, the gates stood open. Planes sat on the runways with their glass canopies open. Avery was talking on the phone when she stepped down from her truck. As soon as she signed off, she walked over to the other four and said,
Okay, the U.S. Navy has an aircraft carrier in range. We'll fly there and get further orders. They're trying to organize a strike force now.
They ventured inside the barracks, which had been converted to a hospital of sorts. Nearly half the staff were caring for the other half. They seemed to all be sick. A man with a captain's insignia, who introduced himself only as Mullins, was in charge.
My CO said to give you any plane you want and our best pilot.
After some discussion, they selected a small cargo transport with the range they needed. They loaded it with as many doses of the cure as it would hold and took off immediately. From a window on the plane, Desmond watched the Australian Air Force men unloading the box trucks, carrying the boxes of jet injectors and vials of the cure into the barracks. We saved those lives. And if they were successful, they would save many more. Peyton slept on the plane, or at least she tried. Her nerves wouldn't settle. Her mind raced with feelings and thoughts she could barely sort out. Desmond Hughes was someone she'd written off, had forced herself to forget about. Now he was back, and she knew her feelings for him were too. They'd never truly gone away after he left. The same was true of her father. Knowing he had been alive all those years, unable to contact her, tore her apart. And then there was the island. If her father was right, it held the key to stopping the pandemic. She wanted that more than anything, even more than her own happiness. She wondered if she would have to choose. If in the tangled web the Sitium had spun, she would have to choose between saving many lives or saving her father or Desmond. In the cockpit, William stared down at the massive aircraft carrier. The USS Nimitz was America's oldest aircraft carrier in service, but the ship was still extremely formidable. Over 3 football fields long and 250 feet wide, with over 4 acres of flight deck and nearly 5,000 crew on board. The sun was setting behind the RAAF cargo plane when the massive city on the sea came into view. William activated the internal speaker.
On approach. Prepare for landing.
The Australian pilot nodded, activated the radio, and called to the carrier's tower.
All sort, this is Rescue Bird. Request permission to land.
The scene on the USS Nimitz resembled the airbase at Edinburgh, though on a much larger scale. A tall man stood on the flight deck, roughly 20 feet in front of about 200 men and women in U.S. Navy khaki standing at attention. The officer met Peyton and the other 3 as they were disembarking the plane, and informed them that the assembled group were members of the ship's crew who had volunteered for this mission. Each was either immune to the virus or wasn't incapacitated yet. They were ready to fight. Minutes later, a fleet of helicopters lifted off, carrying Avery, Peyton, Desmond, William, Charlotte, and the 200 U.S. Navy volunteers. As they rose into the sky, Peyton looked down and saw crews moving the boxes of the cure out of the transport plane. They had brought 5,000 doses, enough to save the entire crew of the Nimitz. They landed on the USS Boxer, which Peyton thought looked like a smaller version of the Nimitz. She soon learned that the Boxer was part of a U.S. Navy expeditionary strike group, a collection of ships capable of deploying quick reaction forces via land, sea, and air. In a conference room just off the bridge, Colonel Nathan Jameson, the commander of the 11th Marine Expeditionary Unit, briefed the 5 of them on the reconnaissance his crew had gathered during the 5 hours since Avery's contact had begun coordinating with the United States Department of Defense. An image of a harbor appeared on the screen. Massive canopies hung overhead. Jameson's voice came out like a growl.
"We haven't observed any vessels departing or arriving."
William stood beside him at the whiteboard.
"You likely won't."
Through the windows, Peyton saw more helicopters arriving, unloading troops. The Boxer was gathering all able-bodied Marines and Navy personnel from ships scattered throughout the Pacific. The colonel had told them that his unit typically had 2,200 active-duty personnel, but the X-1 Mandera virus had decimated their ranks. Peyton wondered how the Sishium had gotten the virus onto so many ships.
Had they used the water, packing tape, and boxes the team had discovered at Aralsk 7?
Or was there another delivery method for the armed services and other isolated populations? On the whiteboard, her father sketched a map of the island's buildings and roads.
"This is how the island looked in the mid-60s. That's the last time I was there."
He paused for a moment. Peyton thought he was remembering something. She wondered what it was. He pointed at a building far inland, away from the main road.
"This is the administrative building. It's the primary office complex on the island. I think the Sishium leadership will be there. If so, the main server farm will be too. We get in there, get Avery logged in, and she'll be able to get direct access to the Sishium's files, including, hopefully, the list of warehouses around the world where the cure is stored."
Colonel Jameson began describing his plan, which involved paratroopers landing at the administrative building and amphibious vessels making landfall on a deserted beach a few miles from the harbor and immediately sweeping through with thousands of troops. Air support would begin as soon as the paratroopers hit the ground. Peyton and the other 4 of them would follow once the site was secure. When Colonel Jameson had finished, William said,
"It's a good plan. An attack with overwhelming force is the correct approach under normal circumstances."
Jameson stared at him. "However, we have an advantage."
"Which is?"
Jameson growled. "Surprise. Knowledge of the terrain. And working against us, we have an enemy that is sublimely clever. They may well be prepared for a head-on assault in ways we can't anticipate. Casualties will likely be high."
"The cost of failure is even higher,"
Jameson said. "True enough. But I believe we should consider an amendment to your plan. A precursor, if you will. I suggest that the 5 of us land at your identified insertion point, reconnoiter the target zone, and make our way to the administrative building, where we will attempt to gain entry and obtain the objective." Jameson shook his head.
"Too risky. If you're discovered, we lose the element of surprise."
"I rate your plan as even more risky, Colonel. Landing in the harbor and on the beaches in force, gives the Sishium time to delete the very files we're after. No, it simply won't work.
The two men argued at length, with no one else able to get a word in. Finally, William raised his voice.
I'm not a civilian. I was previously in the employ of Her Majesty's Secret Intelligence Service, and we were very, very good at exactly this type of operation.
The assertion didn't dissuade Jameson. In fact, it enraged him. The two men did, however, come to a compromise. The five of them would land at the beach with a smaller strike force of Navy SEALs and Marine Force Recon. The main assault force and air support would be on standby, ready for rapid deployment. Outside the briefing room, Peyton's father whispered in her ear, I need to speak with you. When they were alone, he said, On the island, I want you to stay close to me.
Okay.
And keep Charlotte close.
Is she?
Trust me, Peyton, okay?
All right.
You may learn things that will disturb you.
Dad, what are you telling me?
I'm only telling you to be ready. And to stay focused on the objective, finding the list of sites holding the cure.
Desmond stood on the flight deck, the wind blowing on his face. Helicopters continued to land. Troops were massing for the assault. The sun was setting now. There'd be wheels up within an hour. Avery walked over, stood beside him silently for a few minutes.
We need to talk about what you remembered at your childhood home, she said.
He spoke without looking at her.
No, we don't.
Des, at least tell me what you're going to do about it.
I have no idea.
Chapter 109 Desmond found Peyton in one of the mess halls, sitting alone, a plate of untouched food on the table in front of her. He picked up a tray, loaded up on beef stew and cornbread, and sat down across from her.
Not hungry?
He asked.
Starving.
I'm nervous, too. She pushed some green beans around her plate. I'm used to going into dangerous situations, high stakes.
But this is different.
She nodded. And there's something else.
Such as?
He wondered if she was talking about him, about them.
Charlotte, she said.
He raised his eyebrows.
She's connected to you and me. Don't you think that's strange? And I can't think of a reason why someone was sending her supplies. It's just too many coincidences. We're missing something. A very big piece.
Desmond sat silently for a moment. This wasn't the conversation he wanted to have, but it was intriguing. She was right as usual.
I don't know what it means, but I figured something else out. It's taken me a very long time.
Peyton sat silently, searching his face.
15 years ago, when I left you in Palo Alto, I thought I was doing the right thing. For both of us. I thought you would have a better life without me. Kids, happiness, a normal husband.
She began to speak, but Desmond stopped her.
Just give me a minute. What I'm trying to say is that I thought time would heal me. It didn't. I wasn't better off alone. I wanted you to know because you were right. I wish I'd never left.
It's in the past, Des.
I wanted to say it just in case
we don't come back.
Yeah.
I tell you what, let's make a deal. If we do make it back, we won't talk about the past, only the future and the present.
Deal.
Day 14. 6,100,000,000 infected. 18,000,000 dead. Chapter 110. Alim was sewing up a cut on the young girl's arm when the speaker in the exam room called out,
Dr. Kibbett, dial the operator. You have an urgent call from the MOH.
The MOH was the Ministry of Health, or what was left of it. The nurse assisting him glanced at him, but he continued sewing up the girl's arm.
You're being very brave, he whispered to the young girl.
That made her smile. He didn't ask how she'd gotten the cut, but he had instructed the nurse to ensure she had a safe place to stay before discharging her. The voice over the speaker was calling him again as he walked to his office. The operator connected him to the Ministry of Health. Demiria's voice on the line was music to his ears. They'd both been working around the clock, and he desperately wanted to see her.
Elim, the general staff just called.
He sat up. The military was now the closest thing Kenya had to a functioning government.
The UN has contacted them.
They've made a deal with Greece and France to get a small number of doses of the cure to every nation. We're going to get 7 doses within 2 hours. A Greek jet is flying them here.
That's wonderful.
The general wants all the doses, but we told him we needed at least 1 for research in hopes of making more of the cure.
Aelim smiled.
That was very smart.
The truth was, they didn't have the facilities to effectively research and manufacture a cure. But he did have use for a dose of the life-saving medicine. It would help him fulfill a promise he had made, and repay a debt.
When the doses of the X-1 Mandera cure arrived, Aelim personally went to the military headquarters at the Ministry of State for Defense Complex in Nairobi's Hurlingham area. 1 dose had already been used for the general currently leading Kenya's defense forces, and the general was using the other 5 doses to test the loyalty of those under his command and root out anyone who might challenge him. It was proving effective. 2 other generals and 3 colonels had been assassinated that morning. All had been discontent with the current leadership. People were falling in line, and Aelim could sense the change at the military complex. As soon as he got the dose, he rushed back to Kenyatta National Hospital and raced through the corridors. He brought 5 of the survivors from Dadaab to protect him, and the cure. They were an intimidating presence in the hospital, but they were necessary. Inside the patient room, he quickly administered the dose. He hoped he wasn't too late. He tried not to think about the patient as he conducted his rounds. Hours went by without word. He wondered if the cure wasn't 100% effective. He was diagnosing a middle-aged man with hepatitis E when he got word that the patient was awake. That was a good sign. He pushed open the door to the room. Hannah was sitting up in bed. Her eyes were sleepy. Black bags hung under them. Moving her limbs seemed to take immense effort. Aelim remembered vividly the wasting away the deadly virus had brought with it. He had been forced to almost start over, to learn to walk again and to use his muscles. He knew she would have to travel the same road, but he saw strength in her eyes. "They tell me I have you to thank for my recovery."
Aelim shook his head. "I was just a delivery man."
"But you made the decision."
"I did. It's the hardest decision any person will ever make. Whose life to save? It's especially difficult for physicians."
"And you chose me."
Aelim answered the question she was really asking. Why? He knew what she would go through next. Survivor's guilt. Hannah was a physician and an epidemiologist. She had dedicated her life to saving others. Now Aelim had put her before them, at the front of the line.
"A couple of weeks ago, a group of very brave strangers came to help my people. We were dying. They put their lives at risk to help us. They brought what they believed was a life-saving cure for the virus, ZMAP. They brought it for their own people, but they agreed to give a single dose to my government, who gave it to me